Hello, everyone. I am delighted to say that today I had the pleasure to have the wonderful Matt Aaron as a guest on the Humans of Crypto podcast. We've just discussed a whole bunch of things, basically, from his experience at Bitcoin.com as the podcast host of Humans of Bitcoin, his experience with, you know, House Cash Venezuela, and his experience as well right now with UniWhales. We shared a lot of tips about the industry. He shared his favorite object in the show and tell, and it was really an honor to have him as our first guest, and he challenged me to invite him again on the 100th episodes of Humans of Crypto. Enjoy! Welcome to this Humans of Crypto podcast. I'm so happy to be joined by the one and only Matt Aaron. We're here to discuss everything about him and more. Matt, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me, Eleanor. Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, why are you here? Why do you think we had to? I think there was one specific topic that I wanted to talk, and it was you're passing the torch right here today.
Yeah, so when I got into crypto, 3 or 4 months in, I joined Bitcoin.com and had an incredible experience there. I worked there for 2 years. I ran the podcast network and as well as biz dev in Central and South America. And in doing that, I created a network of shows. One of them was called Humans of Bitcoin. And the idea was to cover the human stories, not so much focused on the technology or the price, which was, or the news, like some other shows, and tell the human stories behind Bitcoin, along with Katie, who, you know, was there for the first season. And we did, I don't know, like 5 or 6 seasons. I can't remember, but quite a few episodes, and talked to so many different people from like the OGs, like Vinny Lingham and Eric Voorhees, to Apollo Ono, the Olympic champion, to Lynn Ulbricht, the mom of Ross Ulbricht. I mean, I'd have to look at the list, but quite a few people. And it was really eye-opening for me. And then you reached out to me a month ago and said, hey, I want to start a show called Humans of Crypto, not Bitcoin, but Humans of Crypto, which is, I think, Life on Crypto and Humans of Crypto were other potential titles for it. And I was like, yeah, I'd love someone as talented as yourself to like keep this thread of human stories going on, because there are hundreds of crypto podcasts out there, but I think there's not enough focus on the human stories. And then you have the unintentional human stories, which is about 80% of crypto podcasts. They just think they need to ask this because they haven't studied interviewing. So you say, so tell me, how did you get into crypto? But the podcast is about investing or something else. Yeah. And it doesn't really flow. So I'm excited to be here. And I don't think I even need to pass on the torch, but it was just nice of you to reach out. And it's cool. It's cool to be interviewed every once in a while and have a conversation with someone as lovely as yourself.
This time you're in the guest spot. And I guess of course I want to tell the stories. And I remember being influenced by your work, like your podcast. And I must be honest, I didn't listen to the 231 episodes. I have a lot to live up to. But I obviously, for me, this was content that I just absorbed. I just loved it. I loved hearing the stories. I love hearing more about the people. I usually do it in person, but due to everything that's happening this year, we can't do it anymore. And yeah, I had to reach out to you. I was like, I need to ask the creator of the Humans of Bitcoin if I can do Humans of Crypto. Thank you so much for being here. It means a lot, I think, to have like someone like you who has seen so much, has know so many people, to be able to talk about your story and what you've been doing basically in crypto.
Well, there's not a shortage of stories, so I'm not worried about you having content for the podcast. One thing I'll say is some of the best stories people don't want you to tell, and usually for good reason, but there's amazing stories that can be told, and maybe you can elicit them over some wine or get them to share.
Do I need to get you drunk for this? I haven't included alcohol in the podcast for me. It's like, okay, grab your shot. We're going to start cracking open. No.
You know, it's only 1 o'clock here. Having said that, if I had a glass of wine right here, I'd probably drink it. But yeah, no, I'm going to be as open, as candid as possible. Candor has kind of been my, just my style. Just being very open about things in general as a heuristic. But, you know, why am I here today? So I left Bitcoin.com at the end of 2019, and I'm still in it, but I've been in the food business for a long time. I had a food podcast. That's how I got into podcasting and exporting fruit. Anyway, I had some tokens left over from the 2017 boom. And in July or August last summer, I was checking them, and it's very painful because you put in they all went down to nothing. There were only a couple hundred dollars left. And there was one token that had actually was up 7x. I wasn't dead yet. And I was like, wow, I have a 7x return. You know, I bought maybe 2 ETH worth and had 14 ETH or something like that. And I used Uniswap for the first time. And then I realized, oh, wow, this is it. This is the future. Some of the promises of decentralized exchanges, in this case, an automated market maker. But the point is, like, you know, an actual decentralized exchange, it's working. And that brought me back into the DeFi. And here I am, you know, co-founded a DeFi analytics community and accelerator, and going full steam ahead on that. And it's been a roller coaster ride over the last 4 or 5 months. So yeah, I did leave crypto and kept an eye on it, but...
So you say that, so just for those that don't know, because you haven't said the word, it's called Uni Whales. Like, you should go and check it out. It's a very smart name, by the way, because you have, it has everything. It's, you know, Uni, Sushi Swap, Uni Swap, everything. And then Uni Whales, I think it's a very, you know, you're in that continuation of that market. It's very smart. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more, like, how do you create something like that? How did you, obviously you saw that coin that had, you know, wasn't dead. And you thought, wait, maybe other people want to see that their coins aren't dead? Like, what were you trying to do here?
So I should say, I'm technically co-founder, but I didn't come up with the idea. The idea was Timur, my co-founder, who started a channel. It was just a Telegram channel tracking the large trades on Uniswap. But I was the sixth subscriber to the channel. We have 8,100 now. And we just started going back and forth, some feedback on what it could do. And then we decided to make a token gated access where you could get a premium version that would give you access to a token gated Telegram chat, which we call our DAO, as well as access to the web app with access to content. You know, I continue to do interviews of top people and community calls, you know, keeping the, I got to use this expensive mic system, right? And, you know, it's gone pretty well. We've got a community of over 300 paid members and a pretty select community, I'd say, and knowledgeable, whether it's devs, builders, investors all over the world. And just the power of a community that helps guide the development of a data analytics app. And that's the central theme of what we're doing.
And at what point, you know, how can I join now? Is it Telegram? As a user, I would say, like, Telegram, join the DAO. And as an investor, just hit you up. Like, how does that work?
So as a investor or user, you can just go on to SushiSwap or Uniswap, buy 5,000 UWL tokens. And basically what it does is we use something called Collabland that verifies you have that many tokens in your wallet. And that gives you access into the web app and the Telegram channels. We also have a whale version, we call it a whale tier, which is 16,000 tokens. But and so if you are in that, also, we also have token gated content. So for interviews, you have to watch one of our interviews, you have to prove you have the tokens to get access. But the cool thing is, and this is very experimental, if you decide that Uni Whales isn't for you or you don't have the time, et cetera, you just sell your tokens and you get your tokens back, which obviously can fluctuate with the price of Ethereum. But that's it. It's token gated access to our app and community.
Great. Do you have like any, when you say DAO, does that mean that you use it for governance as well of your own product? Do people vote on stuff or is that not where you...
Right now it's benevolent dictators. Long term, we want to go to a DAO, but it's very complex having decentralized governance. So it's a very light DAO in the way we use that word. But in the long term, yes, we will have more voting in more complex features and capabilities. But right now, it's more just a token gated Telegram chat where the members get to suggest features and then we decide which ones to implement. So we have a really good feedback loop there, but it's definitely not governance at this point.
All right. No, it's interesting. So this is obviously what you're in right now. You're full into this Uni Whales, and this is the result, I should say, of several years of entrepreneurship and years in crypto that have led you to basically found this new product, right? Was this always on your roadmap? Did you know that you would at some point, like how do you stumble or get to this position basically where you're creating a platform with hundreds of thousands of users?
Yeah. So Kai, who worked with me at Bitcoin.com, he was a journalist here. He sent me the group as soon as it launched because he knew I was getting into DeFi analytics with another buddy who's also in our DAO. And he's like, you should check out this channel. I just got addicted to the channel. So, I mean, there was a lot of luck there, a ton of luck that I got introduced. And it was just something that I was using like 10 hours a day. I was just following these trades. So, you know, when like you like something a lot, it's usually a decent sign that other people might find it useful. And that's how I got in. And And, you know, the timing was right. You know, we still got a long way to go. I mean, we're early stage, but I just like any startup, right? I think the, you know, there's no sure thing. 90% of these things fail, but we feel like we have some momentum and a nice culture brewing. So we're going all in on this and we're going to, you know, lay it out. We're going to continue to lay it all on the line and try to make this thing a long-term sustainable ecosystem.
It's so interesting that you said that you were one of the first users, and so you really have seen it grow. And I think when you're passionate about what you're creating and you know the product and you feel like you needed it, you thought, wow, this is amazing. And now you're part of it. I hear a lot of people right now that are reaching out to me and saying, I'm thinking of joining crypto. I don't know how this works. You know, where can I apply? And I just tell them, just, it's kind of weird. It's kind of just go out there, stumble upon something, stumble upon a team you really like. Would that be a good, you know, tip for someone that wants to join crypto? Like, what would you do?
Yeah, two things. One is just using. You don't have to put a ton of money into it, but try using these products is the best way to learn. Like, I have a buddy of mine who wants to sell his coffee business, and he's like, I want to put it into Bitcoin, and I'm going to figure out if there's other things I can do here, because he's been in the coffee game for a long time, and it's quite difficult. Exporting coffee and selling to, you know, it's a whole thing. The coffee business is one of those romantic things that's actually very, very hard. Like, it's like starting a restaurant, you know, it's like everyone started a restaurant, but it's very hard to do. Anyway, he's like, I should buy Bitcoin. He's like, I want to put like 150K in. And I was like, dude, you should just buy $2,000 worth today, put it into a wallet, play around with it and understand it. Because just to do all this like academic, you know, intellectual research and then make the decision, do I buy 150K or zero? I don't think is the way to go about it. I think just experimenting and learning and trying. The cool thing about all these projects, you find one you're interested in, you can join the Telegram or Discord and just hang out. People will ask your questions. The leader of the project will be there to answer questions. I think that's the only way to do it, is just dive in head first and learn. And also, if it's like people say, I want to make money in crypto, yeah, maybe you can invest. And if you have an investing background, that's possible. But maybe you should just get a job and get your salary in crypto, which is pretty much what I did. I mean, my early stage investments into crypto probably broke even, or maybe did okay because I got some early Ethereum, but, you know, many losses, and was very amateur in the 2017. But getting paid at Bitcoin.com, I had a monthly salary coming in. So I think if you can get paid in crypto, that might even be the best way, because you're working full time, so you're learning, you're getting paid to learn, and you're earning your crypto. You don't even have to outlay any cash for it. So I still think that's an underrated thing, and there are so many jobs in crypto right now. And you don't even have to be a developer. If you're listening, you're not a developer, that's okay. Obviously, if you're a front end or back end developer, I won't say it's easy to get a job, but there's so much demand out there. They need that UI UX design as well. But also, you know, communications, sales, marketing, biz dev, you can find it if you really want it.
Yeah, it's definitely an industry where it's like, just go get it. It's kind of scary. It's kind of, yeah, just go jump, just go swim. You'll find people or other fishes that are like you, or another team that, you know, you're sensitive to. And it's difficult. I think for a lot of people that come from the normal or like the fiat industry, it's more like, you know, they want to apply to something. They want to know that they have the right credentials. They want to make sure that they have everything lined up. It's quite scary for people that are leaving like a 9-to-5 job. They know crypto's cool, but it's that jump. And it's like, yeah, there's this whole philosophy of kind of, it's permissionless, it's open. And you also see it in the job market. I think it's more like, it's not about your credentials. It's not really about, it's more about who you are and your skills. And if you want it, then you can make it. It's a lot of freedom and independence as well, which can be very scary. But look at you here now. You had a wonderful crypto career at Bitcoin.com, and now you're at UniWells. I want to roll back a bit the machine and say, what was your first encounter with crypto? Like, what was that first moment? Can you remember? Is that just so far away?
Well, I remember being told about it, but like the first, like, also it's kind of funny. It's very polemic, but like the first like decent money I made on crypto was betting on Donald Trump to win the 2016 election. So I found a site that accepted Bitcoin. And
so prediction markets, this is how you got in?
It was a betting market that accepted, a betting site that accepted Bitcoin at the time. But yeah, like But when I really started to learn was in 2017. Mm-hmm. And I've told the story before where I was having some rough times in the fruit business, took a free course on cryptography, started learning about Bitcoin. And then I started my own hobby podcast called 5 Minute Crypto. We had like, I don't know, maybe 18 to 24 listeners total. And I interviewed Roger Ver in December 2017. And a week later, you know, because it was pretty just, that was a bull market time. Yeah, come on, start a podcast network. Okay, you're hired. And I joined Bitcoin.com. But really where I got into crypto was with the 2 years I spent at Bitcoin.com.
Wow. Can you tell us more about that first interview with Roger Ver? I think those who don't know Bitcoin Jesus, I mean, I'm not sure who out there doesn't know Roger Ver, but can you tell us more about who he is?
Yeah, Roger Ver is, back in the day in like 2011, he was the only biz dev investor in Bitcoin, blockchain.com, Kraken, Zcash, Ripple, BitPay. He was the only guy, and he still is adamant about Bitcoin, but now adamant about Bitcoin Cash. I mean, it definitely fell off in terms of the overall community, I would say. It fell off as in, you know, he definitely entered a different niche when he continued with Bitcoin Cash, which he would claim is Bitcoin's original vision. I don't like talking about it too much because I'd rather have people debate the tech, and it's become such a hateful, polemic thing.
No, I love it. Let's okay. dive into the scalability debate. This is a big blockers podcast. This is fine. But I think Roger is such an emblematic figure. And then also, you're right, invested in so many companies that are here today and are totally making part of the ecosystem. And then Bitcoin.com, which was a big part of your life, right? That where you learned so much. But we owe to Roger Ver, and he, of course, inspired so many of us. But I'm wondering about that first interview, what it must have been like to have him there, you know?
Well, when I started Bitcoin.com, I didn't really know much about Bitcoin Cash. And so it was 5 minute crypto. So it was, tell us about Bitcoin Cash in the 5 minutes. And then I asked him about how does someone get involved with Bitcoin Cash? And this is why I got the job, is because his last answer was, just get a job at a company that pays in Bitcoin Cash. So literally two of my listeners reached out to me of the 20, there's very few listeners of 5 minute crypto, said, who pays people in Bitcoin Cash for a job? And so I should find this email, but I emailed Roger that question. He said, Bitcoin.com, you looking for a job? And I said, yeah, well, I have podcasting experience. Maybe I can build the podcasting network. Literally a week later, I started. 3 weeks later, I'm at the very wild. It's run by a guy that lives, a Canadian guy that lives in Amsterdam, the Miami Bitcoin Conference, the Bitcoin Conference that was January every year in Miami.
Wait.
I interviewed him for Humans of Bitcoin. What's this guy's name?
Amsterdam Dev Miami. No,
It's called.
I feel like I should know him. I'm not linking the dots.
The Miami Bitcoin Conference. It's the.
The
North American Bitcoin Conference. It's the North BTC Miami founder. I can tell you his name. This guy, he's like a mover and shaker. Originally from Mo Levin is his name. I think he married a Dutch girl and lives in Amsterdam now.
The name is familiar, but I don't think I've had the chance to meet him. All right.
So Mo Levin, he's been doing events almost 10 years now, I think. And anyway, so that's where it started. But yeah, and so I joined that world and was part of it for 2 years. And it was an incredibly interesting experience. And it's really, thanks to that I got all these connections and learned from the inside out, because they're very well, Bitcoin.com still is very well connected.
Do you think it shaped your view of crypto or what crypto should be? Like the ethos or the philosophy behind Roger,
I learned a lot
defending.
About ideology, and I think that I try to be very careful to say what crypto should be. I have what I want it to be. I don't know if it should be, because there's all these second, third, and fourth order effects, and the way it turns out is different. I have some, I just still feel it's so early, and I have a little bit less conviction in what I'm doing. That's why I'm working on an analytics app. We're just tracking all these protocols, and I can't tell you which one's going to win out. I love the peer-to-peer payments. I think I always will. And I think anyone listening to this podcast would agree with that. Web3 payments in general. I'm definitely motivated by frustration of using the banking system, just how limited it is and all the paperwork and everything that it takes. And, I don't think I need to convince other people listening to that podcast either. I mean, I think those two things are there. I think cutting out middlemen and faster, cheaper. I'm someone who, especially working in the Colombian fruit business, is just allergic to all this paperwork and red tape. It's really soul crushing for me. So having to fill out forms and call and send faxes and sign.
Faxes.
And
verify
your social security number 4 times and all this stuff to send a $10,000 payment. It's I just want it to be boom, boom, boom. And so I like the innovation of finance, and I think it's incredible. And the DeFi definitely opened things up to me too, just to see all these different financial protocols working together. Whereas in the traditional world, you know, they're kind of all siloed and working against each other. So it's just so much faster the way it develops. But yeah, like does that give you a decent answer there? Or?
There's no good or bad answers. It's just, I think when we talk about Rajivir, Bitcoin.com, Bitcoin Cash in general, when we put those three things together, we automatically think about peer-to-peer electronic cash. And we think about, you know, decentralized payments and borderless, beautiful world where anybody can send, receive cryptocurrencies and have internet magic money. And you're right. It's so much more, right? With DeFi, for decentralized finance in general and with decentralized exchanges and all these innovations that are happening in BCH is just part of it, but it's not the whole cake, or is BCH the whole cake and DeFi just a distraction? So people would argue that I think it's everything, right? So we need everything. We need one that is cheap. We need cryptocurrencies that are cheap to send. And we also need automatic market makers. So we need, I want it all. You know, I want the beautiful DeFi world to succeed. And it's already succeeding with volumes that we would never have imagined just 2 years ago, and today they're surpassing Coinbase and all the centralized exchanges are like, oh, how do we stay relevant? How do we compete? We can't. Okay. Okay. Next. So it's really interesting what we're seeing. But the idea still, the ideals, the philosophy of cryptocurrencies, I know you don't want to talk maybe too much about the ideology and you're It is early. You're right. It's totally early.
Let me tell you a story that kind of goes that a tangible story. So like the whole like Visa is going to use USDC to settle payments. I do understand if you look at a diagram of how like what happens when you pay with a credit card and how many different processors and things, it does make sense logistically on the back end. But then I was able to talk to some people that had invested in Circle, and they were speaking with the Visa team. They're like, yeah, this is very similar to 2017, 2018. This is not like the CEO and like the top people in Visa's integrating USDC. This is just like, you know, some random division of three people on like the Kuala Lumpur or some, I'm just whatever city office kind of experimenting with. It's not like USDC is an integral part of Visa. And that's where my peer-to-peer cash comes in. I'm like, listen, you can use, there's plenty of apps for this, but I think the easiest one is Coinbase Commerce. Right now, any website can, or person, because you can create payment links, can use Coinbase Commerce. It's non-custodial and you can accept Bitcoin Cash, Ethereum, USDC, Litecoin, Bitcoin right now without having any tech or coding experience. Like that to me is still the thing.
Your Coinbase Commerce versus BitPay? Like, do you have experience with those guys?
Yeah. So BitPay is a little bit tricky. I really like BitPay, but they'll do the conversion because Coinbase Commerce is non-custodial. Like it's separate from Coinbase. So you just get the crypto and do what you want with it. BitPay has the option where they'll also convert your crypto to US dollars or sometimes in euros and stuff at the exact rate. But like, you know, when I was in Canada, a friend of mine, she had a flower company and she started to accept it, but it was really difficult because the user over $100 had to do KYC and things like that. It's because they try to work with the banking system. Obviously, BitPay doesn't want that, but Coinbase Commerce is non-custodial, which is whereas BitPay is not. You have to do like a lot of KYC and they'll convert and send to your bank account, which is helpful. But long story short is anyone can use Coinbase Commerce, whereas BitPay it can only be used in certain countries and there's limits on what you can do. Not that it's not an incredible service for the right people.
Yeah, it's when people are asking me how they can use cryptocurrencies and just their normal day-to-day ventures, it's tempting to recommend. Well, I usually recommend Indeed, BitPay, but they have changed Indeed, and especially with the new AML D5 in Europe. Like you're right, there's more KYC AML even on the even on your counterparty. So not just you emitting the invoice, but now the person who's fulfilling the invoice, they also have to KYC, whereas in the past they didn't have to. And now
if I'm buying something for $200, I don't want to KYC. You know, it's like you don't have to KYC when you go out to a restaurant in Paris.
I know. Right? I think it's not full KYC though. It's like, but they want your details. Whereas in the past, they didn't take anything. And now it's like, at least your email, like, you know, they want something. And they used to be more lean, but now it's more like, they want to trace a bit more.
Yeah. So, and I get that. That's pressure on BitPay. And I still think BitPay is incredible and in what they're trying to do. And like, just there's so many jobs in crypto that are very, well, first off, like no one talks about the blockchain devs, but like that's obviously beyond the topic of this conversation. I don't think either one of us understands exactly what they're doing, you know, technically, but
don't
like
talk
those
about
are
taproot.
Like those jobs are really, really hard. You're going to miss some parties being like in a you know, Bitcoin or Ethereum developer, but also like the people that have to, a lot of these companies that have to deal with the banking system, like BitPay, that's some hard work, and it's always changing, and like the rules change and they're ambiguous. I mean, the exchanges as well, not easy. Like it's a lot of, like
basically
spend,
all the custodians, basically anything that's an on-ramp, mm-hmm. off-ramp, yeah. anything that's crypto to crypto, it's fine. It lives on its own bubble, like Uniswap, right? All that world is just like, we're so far ahead. We're like rainbows ahead from all of you guys. And then the others that are still trying to onboard the fiat world and make that connection, and that are stuck between weird regulations and users that are a bit lost and they want to get into crypto, but they want something user-friendly. But it's like all these things you have to do to sort of hold people's hands and cater to regulators. Yeah, difficult. Weird in-between place to be.
Yeah, for sure. And it's definitely working at Bitcoin.com and talking to people, especially like Eric Voorhees, when he talks about how much like mental space it takes for the compliance and regulation part. Yeah, it's going to be a battle. I think maybe some people that have, you know, just like I did when I came in 2017, and people are like, oh, like it's going to take over everything. Like this is it. This time is different. But then you realize, wow, this is going to be a long, hard fight. And there's people that do not want crypto to succeed. I still am under that impression, and they're going to fight pretty hard.
That's an interesting point of view. Do you still think that they're going to wake up and fight us? Or do you think we're already past the fight and they're going to just let us roll?
Oh yeah, I think the fight's still going for sure. Like I think and there's maybe a lot of indirect warfare where you like say, hey, we love crypto, like I think like you know, regulars, we love it, but then secretly they don't really let you get into your bank account or, you know, all that type of stuff. Like I think it's be really intelligent warfare.
Yeah, it's like that HSBC bank for example in the UK is not letting people withdraw. So
there
it's
like and HSBC, who is infamous for all their money laundering with cartels, and like
those guys are the freaking worst. Like also, like there were these Hong Kong activists that fled to the UK recently, and shocking, their HSBC bank accounts in Hong Kong were frozen. But it has nothing to do with anything. It's just like a So that bank, I haven't. You know, went down that rabbit hole of investigating like who's behind that bank and who's pulling the strings, because there's obviously an agenda here. Like someone is like making those calls and deciding to close that bank account, deciding to block crypto users in the UK and more. I wonder who's that.
Yeah, like that stuff's going to continue. You know, it's just part of the fight for a future of finance. It's going to be a fight, and that's okay. Just accept it, right? It's not like, oh, like we've won, because people, you know, I talk to people, once they start to get DeFi and just, you know, cryptocurrency in general, like, wow, these banks are so archaic with their 80s software and the way they run. And it's like, yeah, you know what, their biggest weapon is not their technology, because they would lose. You know, that's like a little pistol against like a, you know, like AR-15. You know what I mean? It's just there's no, their weaponry, they don't have it. But what they do, their weapon is like the compliance and regulation and control and their relationship with, you know, the relationship with governance and so forth and regulators. And that's a strong weapon. It's a very strong weapon. And like, I think that's the thing that people underestimate once they see like the Visa or like MasterCard, blah, blah, blah. Cause like the whole idea was to replace Visa and MasterCard, you know? So when they're like, oh, Visa is going to use USDC.
Isn't that
maybe
still the goal?
Positive. Yeah. I don't know. Our goal, but I don't know if it's everyone's goal. And also I find, I'm making a huge generalization here. And maybe it's, you know, maybe it's a privileged thing, but I think like in Asia, they're especially more pragmatic. Not that you don't find them in US and Europe, but they're like, hey, we're trying to make money, and we found this as a vehicle to make money, which is fine. Just like pure capitalism, but there's not as much ideology. And that's why you also tend to find that people in Asia, from my anecdotal experience, tend to do a little bit better at like reading the markets, because they're in it for the money, where sometimes they have less of a tune of what's going on in the US and Europe, and whether it's ideology or whatever. But like, you know, I'm not part of the East, like in the sense that I haven't been to Asia You know, I'd like to go one day, but I realize that's a huge force of money out there and a network out there. So yeah, those are my thoughts there.
What is your, so then you're, say you're not part of the East. Could you then share some of your insight about like being like more like in Latin America, having worked with Venezuela a lot in the past? Like, do you think that there's more, is ideology then more prevalent or more important in that part of the world versus capitalist Asia?
I don't want to speak about capitalist Asia because I've never been there, right?
Super generalization, but yeah.
But I feel like, yeah, like with like Venezuela and stuff, it's hard. But you know, I did learn that like they, in my experience, like they couldn't handle the volatility of something like Bitcoin Cash, and they needed like maybe a stablecoin built on Bitcoin Cash or Ethereum could work. And that was just my experience, so I could be wrong there. Strong opinions, weakly held. I think the banks in like Colombia example, they're have even more control than they do in the US. So it's pretty hard to get around them, but maybe there's just ways to do it. And I'm hoping for it, but I do understand that they're very, one thing I can speak with confidence is like these South American governments are so slow to move. They're very afraid of change. It's, you know, South America is based on tradition and history. They're not really thinking as much about progress. So it's a lot about tradition. Right. And they really revere the past. And there's some good things that come out of that, but not so much about like progress and change. And, you know, I would always laugh when people come to South America, and this is not an indictment of the people, but just the way it's set up. And like, oh, South America is like the future. It's like the next big thing in Central America. And I don't see it. You know, I have friends that have been to Asia that were living in South America, like Matt, you know, this is the future. It's Asia. And I tend to agree with that, with the caveat I've never been to Asia. But I think so. To implement a technology like DeFi there is going to be a challenge, but I do see like the small stories, which I saw with like Jose at EPCH, and then some, you know, some devs in Argentina and people that are using DAI and stablecoins earning interest. Like it's starting to happen. Maybe I'm a bit cynical after having gone through everything and just the slow bear market, but so I'm like cautiously optimistic that, because when you see what you can do for savings and bypassing all these middlemen, that's still really important. And I do hope it gets there. But I mean, some of the same problems that when I started Bitcoin.com exist today, and that it's still really complex to use, whether it's MetaMask or a crypto wallet, it's still not that easy. Getting people to accept crypto still doesn't happen. So yeah, there's some challenges that exist today that are going to take a little bit more time to solve.
Interesting. Yeah. You mentioned, you know, a good product, which is like user friendly, and also for merchants to accept. This is definitely, these are difficult topics, and we still bring them up, and we still try to onboard merchants, and we still hope for like better products. What would be like right now? Obviously, you're going to talk about Uni Whales, but like, what would be like your current setup right now? If you're like you as a user, like, what's your go-to exchange? What's your go-to, like, how do you store your coins? Like, what would be like, you know, your startup kit? Like, what would you tell people, where to go, how to do it?
But what is the goal? Just to learn?
No, like for a beginner. If you were a beginner right now, but also maybe your favorite products that you use, you know, like what okay. do you like to see in a product? Or like, I feel like we need to share more tips, because we sort of have opinions about all these different products, but it's like, what do you do? You know, like what do you use actually? And what do you like to have as features?
You know, when you've been one challenge is when you've been in crypto for a long time, it's hard to have the perspective of a beginner. And I would just consider myself an advanced beginner because I've been in this for 4 years. But to all the things that you take for granted that you know, Eleanor, that they don't know, I would say actually Uni Whales is definitely not for beginners. It's more for, you know, intermediate to advanced people. I think, well, one place to start is like How Money Got Free. And there's also a good book called Infinite Machine by Camilla Russo. One's on Bitcoin, one's on Ethereum. I think reading the history and getting a feel for the culture first is an interesting way to start. So that's always kind of been my preference. So I would read one of those books and just start on the abstract of like, why did this whole thing start? And then maybe dive into some of the projects. Like that's one. And then maybe, you know, join these projects, Telegram and Discords, and and get whatever's a little bit for you, whether that's $10 or $1,000, depending on your income level, just get a little bit and start playing around with it. I think that's worth it. You know, there's there's definitely websites that you can buy a t-shirt, you know, buy something with crypto, go through that checkout process. Like those things are quite beneficial to do.
Just have the experience, basically. Just get out there and play and just
learn the history, then get some experience using it.
Yeah. I always recommend people. So I'm kind of a nerd. I start some of my classes actually putting the Cypherpunk manifesto into people's face. And I'm like, you know, since 1993, they've been saying this and it's quite old. And these are kind of the values that are behind all of this. And, but I do insist on the whole, even if it's a newbie, and I just send them like just 1 year worth of BCH, I'm always like, okay, so now we're going to save your private keys. And I insist, would that be part for you of like, the 101, would that be something that people need to do and be aware of?
I'd say so. The libertarian stuff, like that, which I find to be very important, but I don't know if that really resonates, at least in the US, because the word has been warped into what it's not really meant to mean. Like, and anyway, I personally would steer clear of like the anarchy stuff and just go into like how it works and just intermediate and no middlemen. And try to be a little bit more neutral, because I think, I don't know, that's just my style, but you have like maybe you have a much more persuasive style and you're able to get that across. And so Eleanor,
everybody that joins my class turns out they're crypto anarchists when they leave. No, I'm joking.
That's awesome.
Please continue.
But yeah, so you work with Cindy Wang, who helped when we had the Bitcoin News show. She would give us updates from China, which were just so different. I should pull up my Telegram with Cindy, but like her updates were like, yeah, they're like, and this is not indicative of Cindy. It was, you know, this is just what was happening, but they're like, you know, some crypto exchange had people, like users couldn't get their funds and they're protesting, and then the WeChat got shut down and people are threatening of jumping off the building if they don't get their money back. And it's just like, whoa, this is just so different, right? So I think someone in China, again, haven't been there, I've said it like four times on the podcast, you know, it might be way different than you explain it to someone in Holland or the United States and their background. I think that's, and then people that may feel marginalized by the system, they might really, I think people in kind of a lower income bracket in the US have to pay all these bank fees and Western Union, they might be a lot more receptive to.
Yeah. What about those today that are not only the fees and everything, but now we're seeing negative interest rates in the banking system.
Is that really happening in Europe? Are you really losing money?
No. Yeah. So July UBS negative interest rate. Wow. They announced it beginning of the year. That's insane. And I think
in July it's going to start.
Yeah. At least when I remember from the PR, it was like, we're rolling out this summer negative interest rates.
So if you have $10,000 in there, like, you know,
no,
in October,
it's more.
You have like.
No, it's more. It's only they're putting negative interest rates on accounts that are holding at least $250,000.
Oh, okay. So not the smaller ones. Okay.
Not the smaller ones. So they're starting with those that can afford it, kind of, and that, you know, wouldn't probably notice, or they would, but they'll be like, ah. Too much has, I don't know. I don't know what they're expecting from these users to like either not budge and be like, fine. Or I'm wondering if all like once this gets more out, which I'm guessing will, and then people realize, wait, I can move all that money into crypto and get positive interest rates and significant interest rates and not, you know what I mean? It's like, but it takes a more...
With risk, right? Like there's definitely some risks there.
There's some risk. Some risk. But one's negative, one's positive. I mean.
Yeah, true. I think
yes, there's risk, but once you're actually paying banks to speculate with your money and you're still paying them not to do that, you're losing money basically by keeping it with them. And I don't know.
Yeah, that's one thing I've seen now. It's like selling out of crypto into dollars. It's like, it's just so unappetizing with like 20% of US dollars haven't been printed in the last 14 months.
40,
you know,
40,
I could be off on that, but
40%.
A ton of US dollars were printed last year.
Insane.
In the pandemic. So.
Insane. Yeah, I think that's why that's something that we need to all go back to as well. Or just learn the fundamentals of money. What is money? What, you know, what is fiat today? What is the US dollar? How it's pegged to a whole bunch of countries. I've been teaching classes for Lebanon and it's just their economy is linked to the US dollar. And it's horrible right now. Like people can't withdraw their US dollars from their bank accounts. Completely massive.
Really?
Massive devaluation. It's Venezuela, but like worse. And like now. And
worse.
It's like, I feel like Venezuela had hyperinflation around 4,000%. So I think we're not there, but it's, we've reached at least plus 400% hyperinflation on goods.
And wow.
So in a year. So it already started before October 2019, and then it's just been going down. Every time I'm making a class, I need to adjust the slide on the interest rate, because it's worse and worse and worse. So you need more and more Lebanese lira to be able to be able to get some dollars. And it's a country that has very poor governance, Their central bank is extremely corrupted. It's just doesn't look good. Just really, really doesn't look good. Wow. And so massive capital flight, capital control. So they don't want people to, move their money around. And yeah, people are stuck. People are stuck right now. And I'm not sure. I think some people might still hope that the banks will have to pay back and give money back to people. But I don't know how that's going to happen. They've been trying to, the central bank's been trying to attract, investors to bring capital back to Lebanon. That's not happening. No one wants to put money there. Because for a long time, they had massive return on investment for their investors. So that's how Lebanon kind of worked as like the bank of the Middle East. They kind of did that for a while. No one's putting their money right now in there. Syria, that had a lot of money parked in Lebanon due to international sanctions, they have, I think, more than $40 billion blocked right now.
Wow.
So, Bashar is like, can I have my money back? It's not happening. And so it's like, it's insane right now what's happening in Lebanon. And yeah, I'm on a tangent. Every time I talk about Lebanon, I just get so emotional. But it's just that yeah, we're definitely lucky in Netherlands or in other countries where we can just have access to normal financial mainstream instruments, I think, really.
Yeah. It's totally your experience overrated. With Lebanon, a lot of people in like the US, they don't get that. What's going on in Venezuela or Lebanon? They're like, oh, you just use PayPal, blah, blah, blah. And so I think it's really awesome that you are educating people there in Lebanon. That's super important work. And I can imagine how receptive they are to the message and the information you're providing them.
Yeah. I love it. It's my favorite job. I love being crypto, but I must say I have a massive soft spot for Lebanon, for having studied there in 2014, and then for knowing people there that are just so smart. They're so smart, so literate. They deserve so much better. That's how I feel. I feel like it's such a shame to just sacrifice whole population, all their savings, like, if you had left all your savings in your bank account, you lost 90% value in the last year. I mean,
last year.
Yeah. And you start to pay, everything. Lebanon. Ugh, such a sore. But I'll continue doing this. I'll continue doing classes. I'll continue teaching people and making sure, because you've kind of had these initiatives with Venezuela, right? Like you were also,
yeah.
What was that about? What were you doing at the time with?
So one is I just helped like retweet and along with Bitcoin.com with Jose and EBCH. And then I also helped them, get the Bitcoin Cash House experiment off the ground, where it's just like a small education center where people could learn about crypto. I kind of coordinate all that while I was at Bitcoin.com. But yeah, that stuff is so important. It's pretty heavy stuff to work on. And I think the awareness of what's going on and getting people to care about that, I think, is like Venezuela is really, it's weird. Venezuela is really popular in like aid for Venezuela, I think, when I was at Bitcoin.com, because it was so new. But when a country's been suffering for a long time, it's like a little bit harder because things haven't changed. Like Syria has been in it. Venezuela got progressively worse over the last couple of years. All I'm trying to say is I think that's some really important stuff, but it's a little bit harder to get people to care than I'd like. And you just have to find a way to get around that. But I think that's maybe the piece that's not really being talked about right now. It's all about DeFi and Binance Smart Chain coins and all this stuff. And some of it's really cool. Like, I mean, being able to get a loan on Aave and then maybe withdraw it and put a mortgage on a house is really innovative stuff. Having said that, it would be cool to get a little bit more press around this type of stuff, which is doesn't seem to get that much press relative to the rest of everything that's going on.
I think when you open like any press right now about crypto, is the price has gone up. It's wonderful. It's like it's always or it's so these are either the positive press, which is, oh my god, greed, yay, and then otherwise you have all the horrible news angles, like, oh, someone got hacked, bad, using too much energy. What
NFTs are stupid, things like that, you'll see.
What do you think about that? What do you think about NFTs?
Oh, do you I do have some. I have some hash masks. Think the hash masks. But
I need to Google
that. I don't even want to talk about NFTs. Like? It's like they're if you go to hashmasks.com, there's I think 16,384. But long story short is I'm not an expert in NFTs, but it's become pretty popular. It's like simultaneously two things. One, it's a big fad, but two, there's so many things you can do with NFT, which is ERC-721 token. And I think with like music and art and cash flows, because like everything in life is an NFT, right? Is a like your house is different from your neighbor's house. So if you look at it that way, I think this first wave of just like random artists and celebrities putting out, that's going to be a fad. But then there's going to be a second wave of more collaborative like art, music, real estate, all these things that can be integrated with NFTs. I think that's going to be cool. Maybe similar to the first types of tokens on Ethereum. Most of them didn't have any value. Maybe still they're not quite there yet, but eventually there's really cool ERC-20 tokens. But NFTs, which are ERC-721, I think it's going to go through that same transformation. There's quite a bit of stuff that can be done there. And I've even seen artists that have changed their life because they've been struggling for so long, and then they launch an NFTs and all of a sudden they have some money, which is always welcome for a starving artist. I mean, there's some cool things going on with that, but it's still very early and, the same challenges as crypto, a lot of noise, but some signals will come through and some new cool use cases are definitely on the way.
Yeah. So for those that don't know, and I'm not expecting anyone listening to know, NFTs are non-fungible tokens, and it's a different type of token where you can sort of wrap a bit of metadata around a token. That's why Matt's been saying ERC.
These words like fungible. Before crypto, I didn't know what fungible meant, but fungible means like just $1 can be changed for another dollar. You know, two things that are exactly the same. And so all these tokens, one BCH or one Bitcoin or one Ethereum is fungible because you could trade it for each other, right? But these are unique. So it just means it's unique. You can't trade it. So if Eleanor mints or, creates five different pieces of artwork that are all NFTs, Eleanor's created five NFTs because they're all five different pieces of art. So you couldn't trade one for the other because they're not identical.
It would be like a little bit of, it would be that, that token plus metadata, which would be like usually a JPEG file, like a picture.
Which are sometimes stored on centralized servers or IPFS anyway. They're not really stored on Ethereum.
Or I could change the pictures, right? I'm the centralized artist. So I could sell you a piece of art. I could sell you like that poster, make a picture of that poster, post it online, sell it. That could be an NFT in itself. But what's interesting is the ownership, right?
It's like you can prove that you own it. So there's like, can't be fakes. If you can prove that you earn a certain one, you can see the history of it. So that's what blockchain does, right? So that's a cool part about it for sure.
Immutability of the ownership, but it doesn't automatically convert to the real world. So it doesn't mean that I have to send you now this poster. It's not tangible. It doesn't mean that you have rights over this piece of art. It means
for sure, like I think with all this type of stuff and ERC-20 tokens as well, like there's still like the real world laws and regulations, so you still have to comply with them even if you own it on a blockchain. Like if you make an NFT of your house in Amsterdam and you sell it to me, if I can't
do you
prove,
get the you house know, do you get the, I'm not sure you get the house
thing. I don't think I get the house exactly. So what I'm gonna say, I have this NFT, this because your house is a non-fungible token. So I mean there's definitely some complexities there, especially when you include the physical world. If it's a digital image and stored on IPFS, there might be ways to make it a little bit easier and harder to. But yeah, it's still very early. I think that's the central theme there.
But so you have some hash masks. I think that's interesting. Did you buy them like recently, or were you like?
I bought them right after they launched, and they were only around like 0.4 ETH, something like that.
Why did you buy? Why hash masks and not like?
Because I thought it was popular and other people were going to like it. It was basically, they said it was a collective of artists around the world, but I think it was all computer generated. But there's these 16,000 masks and they have different features, and the more rare ones are worth more money. They have like some features.
I can see that it's from a company or in Zug, Switzerland.
A collective out of Zug. They have, they like did this thing where now you can, mint portraits of it, and then the Hashmask owner gets the proceeds. They have a name change token, which is another cool thing where if you have enough name change token, you can name or rename a mask. And so that was a thing. So there's a couple of wrinkles to it. And then there's going to be no more name change tokens after 10 years. So all the names will, after a certain amount of time, will be set in stone. It's still very new and experimental, but I found it kind of interesting.
Did you name yours? Can I actually search it right now?
Oh, man, I can't. I'll tell you off camera.
Do you know the number? Is, no, it's fine.
I'll tell you why I'm not going to tell you. Just because if I told you the name of the Hashmask, you could find my Ethereum address. This is one of the issues with NFTs. If anyone has an NFT on OpenSea, they may not know this. You can look up their address and see their wallet and their collection.
Is it like one Ethereum address per NFT, or is it? Do you have all your NFTs?
You can
under
have multiple
one?
On. You can have multiple. I have it all on under one address. But the issue is Matt. That if you name it, there's only one name. So like, let's say you have Matt, there could be Matt. That's it. There's it can only name Matt once. But you could have MA space TT. But yeah, like I mean, I would show some photos of the Hashmask. I think it's a cool project. Will it hold long term value? Who knows? You know, it's
we
it's
will
still
display
very
it here. No. Yeah, post prod.
But like that's another thing with UniWhales, like a lot of doxing when people change their Twitter profile because they want to flex with these expensive NFTs they've purchased, like the punks. Like you can reverse look up, you know, their addresses and stuff. Some people have doxed their address, not their personal address, just their Ethereum address because of this. So it's a whole other thing.
It's interesting because I was recently teaching whatever the Crypto 101 and someone So I'm very inspired by our one and only Roger Ver, obviously, but I like to end all my classes by sending a little bit of crypto to people. And then, everybody's putting their addresses in the Zoom, whatever, I do the airdrop. And the next day, someone's like, wait, the address I sent you yesterday is not the same in my wallet today. And it's an HD wallet. So I had to explain that I use Edge. So they were like, yeah, but so what's happening here? And I was like, well, it's actually, so you have one set of keys, but then you have multiple addresses, and every time you will receive funds, actually, the wallet automatically will generate a new address for you so that no one from the class could like trace. For example, if you were like an attendee in the class, you could theoretically track all the addresses that people are giving, but they would only see the €1 worth of BCH I'm sending. They wouldn't see the rest of the activity of the wallet. So I'm surprised that with NFTs that, yeah, but you should just move your NFT, I guess. Oh, but then you could still trace it. You could still
trace. You can always like once you if you own it and you've named it, it can be traced anywhere, unless you sell it. But still, then the NFTs are a bit of an issue there. But there might be ways around it. But more importantly, I would check out the Hashmask, and I have zero advice for. I mean, any of this, not investment advice. For NFTs, I think the people that I do see, they do say like, just collect things you like and think are cool as a barometer. Doesn't mean it's going to have value, but I mean, there's really cool things that can be done. I think that you'll see a lot of use cases that haven't been thought of yet. That would be pretty innovative, but most of it's going to be, you know, a lot of fluff and hype stuff by every celebrity creating their own NFT.
And I think it's interesting that we're seeing like really big celebrities, like really mainstream celebrities that are minting NFTs. Random person I'm thinking of like Jeffree Star. Like, I don't know if you know him, like YouTube makeup superstar. And I was just like, wait, what? And he was like, he had NFTs. And I was like, oh my God, we've reached it. This is it. This is the mainstream moment when everybody is just doing stuff with crypto, or when I saw Grimes minting NFTs as well. So
yeah, that was big.
But then I actually went to the platform. I was interested. I was like, okay, I'm going to research this. I'm going to see. You couldn't directly pay for the NFTs. You had to like preload an Ethereum wallet or, you know, pay in fiat. And I was like, no. So it's like we're still in the beginnings. So I think you're right. It's just like, the future use case are not yet there. People are testing and it's fun. And like Matt said, just buy stuff that you actually like. Like if you do want to invest in NFTs, just imagine you buying that piece of art. If you would buy that piece of art, if it was not an NFT, like, do you really like it? Do you like the artist? Does it have meaning for you? Like, don't automatically buy something because it might have value in the future, because it just, that's a massive gamble. That's a massive gamble. Like with anything.
Yeah, it's always a massive gamble. And collecting art is hard, I think. I'm not an expert in collecting art, but the little I do know, I think it's still pretty fickle, and it's obviously not as liquid as these tokens. And For sure. There's a book called The $12 Million Stuff Shark that talks about how absurd the art market is and how people value things there and the hype and market around it. Kind of an interesting read, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not... Some stuff, some NFTs are art, some others are just very conceptual, like Jack Dorsey's first tweet. You know, it's there's everything and anything really in the market right now. And I think we'll see what the future holds for the NFT, for crypto in general. Maybe we'll see more innovations as well in our blockchains. We'll see, you know, proof of stake coming to Ethereum, native tokens on BCH. Like, there's more things happening on all these. As I like to say, it's an ongoing social experiment. So we haven't seen it all. And these blockchains keep evolving, and hopefully the tech moves along.
By native tokens on BCH, you mean SLP or?
No, no. I mean miner validated tokens. Aha, you need to follow the miner discussions. They're discussing, so basically we haven't had miner validated tokens on BCH. We have non-miner validated tokens on BCH called SLP. So they use the simple ledger protocol for those out there. So it's tokens on BCH, but it creates a lot of problems in the wallets, because the wallet might, so it's basically BCH plus metadata. So we're talking about NFTs before, it was a bit different, right. But it's the same. It's a bit of BCH wrapped with some metadata around it, which can create a token. They're called SLPs. But the problem is that if the wallet that you're storing these SLPs in sends the BCH, it might burn your SLP. So you might lose your tokens, basically, if the wallet doesn't make sure that the wrapped BCH attached to that token stays attached. Okay. And we haven't had non-native tokens, even though it's been discussed since the Tokyo Bitcoin Cash Conference in 2018. I'm not sure right now. Yeah, 2018 Tokyo Bitcoin Cash Conference, where Andrew from Bitcoin Unlimited was mentioning this on a panel, that we could have at some point, and it could enable tokens and models like Maker on BCH. So wow. Where we, that's, I know, cool. I know. Tobias Ruck actually proposed this as well, like 2 years ago, or like when he proposed the Mitra, which was, but that wasn't implemented, and it's doing a comeback. So the conversation is going. Let's see. We also have, like, right now Smart BCH, but it's a sidechain. So it's doing stuff. It's new as well. They also got funded through Flipstarter, so a crowdfunding platform for those who don't know.
I love Flipstarter. Cool.
So yeah, so there's stuff happening, but it's still, you know, I think a lot of people look down on DeFi maybe in the BCH space. They're like, no, we don't need all this stuff. We just need peer-to-peer electronic cash. And now,
yeah,
the conversation is maybe like, wait, actually, we can maybe.
Maybe there's some elements that could be implemented.
Maybe, yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe we don't want the IFP. That for sure is a big no. Like, we're not going that road, but we could still make the protocol where we could innovate more things, basically.
That's cool.
Let's see. BCH is still growing, still going. So, yeah. I think I want to ask you right now. So for those who don't know, this is a bit of a special part of the podcast where I ask our guests basically to bring us an object where we can remember them by. And it can be anything. It can be any object that is important to them, that is something that they like. Matt, what did you bring to the show and tell today?
Okay. So finish off here. This is my Kindle. Kenny. Yeah.
You named it?
Yeah. So I never shared that publicly before.
That's,
but yeah,
cute.
Kenny. And anyway, I've read hundreds of books on this thing, a lot of books. And so I love reading. It's just something I do every night to fall asleep since I don't know, last 12, 13 years. And I don't think I've had this Kindle since then. I think I've had a Kindle for the last maybe 10, 11 years. And because just I've been on the road a lot, or living in South America or Canada and not in the US. So the books were not as ubiquitous. And even though I do like paper books still. And so, yeah, that's been a part of me, just, you know, research. Like, if I got into crypto, I mentioned I would read the history. In food, I like reading like the historical, like learn the history of the industry first. But I also like biography, philosophy, all, popular psychology, evolutionary biology, all sorts of random stuff. Salt, A World History. I'm just thinking of some of the top books I like. You know, The War of Art, some motivational stuff. Anyway, I love reading and I think it's great. And it's definitely been something that I wish I did when I, you know, I didn't start till I was like 24, 25. I wish I would have started when I was like in my teens, but I was just so, I associated with school and I was just so repulsed by school. But, it, you know, it just wasn't for me, I should say. I was repelled by it. But yeah, that's my Kindle Kenny. A Paperwhite. It's probably the first Paperwhite edition. It's lasted for a long time. And that's what I got.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Is it like some, so it's something that you've had on you right now, like all the time? You say you fall
it's
asleep
with
to
me.
It. Is that
I remember times where I would go to, like, speaking of bureaucratic stuff, I'd have to go to some like bank or someplace to wait or wait in some line. And I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't bring my Kindle. This is a huge mistake. And cause I was like, oh, I'm probably not gonna have to wait. And then real world hits and I do. So I have it always with me. I don't think I ever travel without it.
What are you reading at the moment?
What am I reading right now? Let me pull it up. I'm rereading The 33 Strategies of War by Robert Greene, which I like. And then I started The Worldly Philosophers about the great economic thinkers. So that's a pretty cool one. So I'm in those two right now. And then when I want like a really like easy read, just well, it doesn't sound that easy, but I'm reading Blood, Gun, Money about the history of firearms and the legal to illegal firearms trade in North America to the rest of the world. But yeah, those are the three things I'm into right now. Actually, ironically, I haven't been reading as much as I usually do. Those are the things that I'm reading right now.
Amazing. Oh, thank you so much. I think we have a tendency in crypto to be just online so much. And we just need outlets and also to feed our brain with not just crypto stuff, but also like appreciate art and literature and just read and learn. And yeah, thank you for sharing your object with us. I think it's an object as well. I think that shows that you want to continue learning basically. And, you know,
yeah,
it's also a very
I'd
nice
say
outlet.
So not in like a snobby way, but just, you know, no. I'm curious amateur that loves to read and I'll continue to do that. But yeah, I mean, Eleanor, I do have to get back on the grind. This was such a welcome break in my day. I do hope I provided value to your listeners or entering conversation. I appreciate your questions. I'm so excited to hear what you have going on in Lebanon. I think that's awesome. So I feel like that would have been the answer. I would take Eleanor's Crypto 101 class. So I'm going to like shill your class on your, on your podcast, and it's probably the sponsor. By Eleanor Blanc. So,
oh, yeah. Matt, it's been an honor. Go back to the grind. I'm so happy I had you on board for today. And yeah, all the best. And for everybody else, just keep an eye on Uni Wells and on Matt Aaron. You're awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I hope to be back soon. And also one last thing I should say, you should make 100 episodes, at least 50 of this podcast. I think too many people start podcasts and they do like I've done 10 episodes and I haven't gotten like a lot of downloads yet. Like you have a talent for it, but do 100 and you're just going to like, it's just going to click.
Oh my God.
Gonna,
no, well, I don't know.
I challenge people to do that. Like the long-term stuff. Do 100 episodes.
I
write
do
100
keep
blog
it up.
Posts. Yeah.
100. All right. 100 blog posts, 100 guests. Yeah. Let's see you in 100 episodes. I'll invite you back for the 100th one. Oh my God.
Okay. There you go. I will definitely come back. I mean, I think that like, I really admire people that do something for a long time and I can't pretend to be a master at this, but like, a buddy of mine, he's in the best shape of any of my friends I know. He works out once every 5 days and then he goes running once every 6 days. And when he tells people that, they're like, oh, you go 5 times a week. He's like, no, I go once every 5 days. So today is Tuesday. That means his next workout will be Sunday and he never misses. Maybe if he's sick or something, maybe it'll be like, you know, a 50% workout. But he's done this for the last 10 years and he's in incredible shape. And he goes running once every 6 days. So if today was Tuesday, his next day to run is Monday. But like the consistency or the person that swims 2 times a week for 20 years, like I think that's underrated as opposed to like, hey, and like I'm going to, it doesn't have to be sports. It could be anything, but just doing something consistently over a long amount of time. And we overestimate the frequency and underestimate the longevity and consistency. I just think that's super important. I don't say that as advice, but just something that I try to think about and try to aspire to in my own
Definitely. I do admire discipline a lot as well. I find it difficult to implement discipline in my own life, but just having a challenge like this, and not only 100 episodes, I need to live up to 231 from the Humans of Bitcoin. So that I know that. And there's so many interesting people, and I look forward to interviewing more crazy people out there that are in this industry. And yeah, thank you so much for coming today and sharing your experience, Matt. See you in 100 episodes.
Okay, I'll see you in 100. Last thing, can you get, what's that guy's name? You know the guy he's a big Bitcoin Cash guy. Is it James? He left.
James Cramer?
No, not James Cramer, who could also be interesting, but he's the guy who in Wales who left a ton of Bitcoin in a landfill and he's trying to get it out. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know. I'm not sure. But
I'll find his name, but it was a big story. Like hundreds of millions of dollars.
I know the meme. Meme. Like, let's go like shovel and try to find that what is it, a Bitcoin miner or like a computer somewhere in a landfill?
Yeah, he was mining it early, like on a GPU. What's his name?
But James. Yes, I'm open to crazy guests.
I could never get him to do an interview, so maybe you can get him on there. Like, we talked and he told me the whole story, but then James Howlsey on Twitter.
Okay.
But he's still tweeting. He hasn't. Oh,
maybe it's a bit painful. Maybe it's just like some stories are just better untold and they're better for, you know, the myths.
Yeah.
And you don't really want to come on a podcast and explain like how painful it's been because the last 5 or 6 years you've been searching a landfill. It's a bit like, you know, here's a new shovel. Good luck. It's kind of difficult, but
yeah,
I'm open to guests. This is one way for me to learn, obviously. And it's a way for me to show other people what are the people in crypto, right? It's just a wonderful window to not go through the price angle or the greed angle, but more from the stories and learning who's behind all this industry. So one last final word you want to say and share about this industry to our audience?
It's going to be a wild ride. Yeah, that's for sure.
All right, man. See you very soon.